Darius at the Retail Tech Podcast, talking with Kelly Gage at the National Retail Federation Big Show in New York City 2018. How are you, Kelly?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Awesome. So Kelly is a repeat guest, and he's the Chief Product Officer of a company called Commerce Tools, which is a new commerce platform using microservices. So Kelly's probably one of the best architects, technical architects, and that I know. So I always go to him when I have a question about something I don't know. So, which is a lot.
I'll take it.
So today I wanted to talk to you about this new concept for me that I've been hearing about called low code or no code. And what is this all about, and does it have any legs yet?
Well, I mean, you could argue we've been doing low code or no code for a long time. The content management systems, even in the 90s, had WYSIWYG builders, right? You could build experiences for customers, drag and drop things. If you look at the old Visual Basic, right, you could build these nice GUIs really easily. And with a little bit of code behind the scenes, you could make something work. And what we see now is we hear a lot about digital transformation within enterprises, and digitally native companies empower their business users to work with software. And low and no code solutions allow business users or less technical users, or sometimes they're called citizen developers, to build experiences for customers. And sometimes they're internal only processes, right? So if somebody needs an employee satisfaction survey done, a citizen developer in the HR department could use one of these no or low code solutions and pretty quickly capture that information.
Okay. So when I think about software, especially when you get into the business world, there's really two aspects of it. Like you said, one is the internal operations, the other one is the external. So for the customer, for the team that's building tools for the internal customers, they have a different mandate and the way of building those tools, as opposed to, you know, how the customer actually is using the tool to serve their customers, right? So let's say a marketing team. Marketing team is a customer of the IT team, of the internal software team, but they're serving their own customers, which is the consumer. So when we talk about building tools and low code or no code, are we talking about mostly the internal tools or external tools? Because external tools, like you said, a CMS, for example, is no code. A marketing person can go in and change the content on a website without doing any coding for the most part. So that's, we've had that already. So this new, so this is like where my question is that what I'm hearing is that, is it mostly focused on, are you're going to be able to build brand new applications without any software developers for internal use?
It's both, right? And what we've seen is as companies mature and become more digitally native in their orientation, the developer expertise is being pushed to the lines of business. So marketing, for example, used to ticket IT to do any type of project. Now what we see is a very clear trend where marketing will have a handful of these citizen developers, or standard developers for that matter, and they'll be able to then build their own solutions. And it might be that once the concept has been proven, right, you know, maybe a couple developers get together, they do a quick mashup app, test a concept, and when it's proven to be successful, then they'll go back to IT and say, this concept is successful, why don't you go build me a real app? But to answer your question, it's largely for these internal applications. There are lots and lots of these really small applications that power an enterprise. You know, change management applications, employee tracking, expense reports, you know, all of the boring things that are required for a business. And IT is sick of doing that stuff, and they don't have to do all of that. It's not their job to, you know, build a time management system. That should be pushed to these HR organizations.
Right. So that's where the value, I think, would be in the concept of no code, is that the HR person can actually go to a dashboard and pick and choose from services they need and build their own app without doing any code. That's the concept of no code for me.
Right. And that's the dream, ultimately, is, and you see this with organizations like Amazon and Walmart now, increasingly Target, you're starting to see this, where internally they build an enormous catalog of basically Lego blocks. Right? So they might have a catalog of 500 or 1,000 little bits of data. And then you could, and we see some organizations at the top doing this, expose that up to business users and say, this is a big box of Legos, right? Go build something.
Right.
And you don't necessarily have to build something for the next 50 years. You could build an app for a pop-up store that lives for 2 weeks. And the amount of code you have to write, if all the APIs are exposed and made available, if you take one of these no or low-code platforms, it becomes pretty easy to just build a solution, whether that's an internally facing solution or an externally facing solution.
Okay. So it's probably true to say that no-code is a goal, but it's not completely reality yet.
I don't even know if it's the goal. It's more that overall we would like to simplify software development,
right?
And put it in the hands of more people. And the less code you have, generally speaking, I'm going to make the gross generalization, but the less code you have, the easier it is to manage.
Sure, sure. And that's, I think, so no code is probably goes hand in hand with the concept of microservices, right?
Yeah.
The smaller, the more granular your service is, the more flexible it is to fit in to whatever needs to be built, right?
Right.
And the larger it is, the more difficult.
Correct.
So if you have a service that does two things, that actually limits your configuration by 50%.
Right, because you've pre-assembled the Lego blocks and then thrown them into the box.
Right.
And if you have a weird Lego block shape made of five different blocks, it's hard to build something
and this
with
is
that inside of it.
Yeah, this is when I talk to people about microservices, is like the big challenge is that everybody thinks they are a service-oriented architecture. Yes, but your services are doing 10 things.
Right.
And that is defeating the purpose.
And they can't be called independently. And that's the key, is they have to be independently callable.
Right. And trackable. And yeah. So what are some of the platforms or software applications that are being used? So let's say, for example, in the current state of no-code, how does it work? A developer goes and do they use a specific language or?
I mean, there are two approaches, but you can have an actual language that basically your WYSIWYG editor breaks what you build visually down into. And an example of that is like HTML, right? We've forever had WYSIWYG editors in CMSs that produce HTML, right? But you've got to create some kind of code. And there's a step above that, and this is a really emerging, fragmented space where there is no more intermediary language, and it builds an app that basically compiles down to a function as a service. So there is, it's serverless, basically.
Okay.
So, I mean, there, just to summarize, there are two approaches, right? You can build an app and then export that app and then have somebody run that app, or you can use these newer style approaches to actually build a serverless app. So there is no more app to manage. You're just building an experience, and magically in the cloud, I hate to use that term, but you know, magically there's something there that actually keeps the application up and running and functional. And that could be, you know, behind the scenes an AWS Lambda function, for example.
Right. So let's say a stack for a no-code setup would include what right now, for example, if somebody wanted to test it and try it out?
There are a lot of really small companies building their own platforms that do this.
Okay.
But none has really, you could argue that the public clouds all have this to some degree today, because you can build these complex orchestrations, workflows. There's a lot that a semi-technical business user could do within these public cloud platforms. So I think what's going to happen is either one of those is going to catch on, or the founders of one of those within a public cloud will go out and build something that then gains momentum. But right now, there's no standards, and that's what concerns people is, you know, next week the vendor could be gone.
Right.
It's just such a nascent space.
That's actually a good point, because the cloud vendors would be probably at one of the best positions
right.
to do something like this, to really take it to the next level. Right. I mean, there's... So, talking about the cloud, really, there, how many major cloud vendors are there now?
Three. There's AWS, there's Google Cloud, and there's Azure.
What about Oracle?
You're killing me. Now, Darius is asking me pointed Oracle questions because I used to work for Oracle.
And you know, I mean, you know,
there's a
fair question. I know Oracle's been focusing on, so I'm just wondering.
There's a large second tier of clouds out there, Oracle being among them. And these offerings are limited. They're fairly siloed. And I don't think many of them meet the full definition of cloud. So I define cloud as I, as a person with a credit card, can go in, provision some capacity. And an unstated goal of cloud is I don't want to get harassed by salespeople. With no offense to salespeople.
Right.
And AWS does that. Google does that. Azure mostly does that. Right. You can go in, do what you want. It's fully sold on a metered basis. You're not being pushed to sign a multi-year contract. There's no commitments. It's strictly... And at Commerce Tools, when we negotiated a contract with Google Cloud, there were no financial terms whatsoever in the contract. And the other cloud vendors are like that as well. It's strictly a data privacy agreement. And, you know,
it's just more
legal
democratic.
Things. And it's nice because the price list is the price list. And with that second tier of cloud vendors, the price list is not the price list. The price list is a starting point for an extended negotiation for a multi-year contract. And to me, immediately that disqualifies. Now, so, there's some cool work being done, but still, it's three who own 90%+ of the market at this point.
Yeah. So it's not just the technology, really, that's being disrupted. It's a business model.
It's now, entirely the business model.
If you haven't noticed, the conversation changed to the cloud, but I think this is an important discussion as well. So it's really the business model. And customers are also gravitating towards the new business models, where it's more transparent and they have more control and they're not locked in for long periods of time. So for the established companies, the older companies that have been in this business, if they really want to innovate, they need to also innovate in the business model, not just in technology.
The hardest thing that a traditional enterprise can ever do is hand a corporate credit card to some developers and say, go build something. Because IT has forever, since its establishment in the 60s or 70s or 80s, depending on the company, IT forever has sought to control. And they've controlled the programming language, the operating systems. They have very strict policies, procedures. It's meant for a shared services model. That's how most organizations operate. And if you need an operating system installed, you know, Jim in the corner who's been doing it for 20 years is the guy you got a ticket, and eventually he'll get to doing it. Right?
Right.
And to bypass all of that existing infrastructure and hand a credit card to some developers in marketing and say, go build me a pop-up shop, a digital pop-up shop, or go build me a chat bot. The tools now exist to do that, but enterprises are very hesitant to give anybody that level of control. And what that ultimately does is impact productivity, because if you've got to go through IT to build a chat bot, that's a year plus long project. It's it's an 18-month project. And if you were to hand a credit card to some developers and tell them to go on AWS, you could probably do that in a week with a couple standard developers.
You mentioned chatbots, and I had a question. Is Commerce Tools looking at providing chat as a service?
We do that today.
You do that today? Okay,
yeah,
cool.
We do that today.
Cool. Just an off question that just came up. So actually, the what you mentioned, it reminds me almost of like the no-code concept. Is if you look at all these different pieces all the different people that had to be involved in building a new application, from IT to the development, to the customer. Different disruption is happening at different levels. So no, when you actually hand the card to the developer to go and build and bypass the infrastructure side, because it's already handled by the cloud, you've almost like you've progressed in the no-code cycle in one step.
Right. An organization's goal should be, the only goal of the organization is, how quickly can we get something released to customers, right? The back office stuff, it's important, but it's not going to make or break your business. The goal should be, how quickly can we get something in the hands of a customer? And a secondary concern is, how quickly can we get the second version of that? Because innovation requires iteration. And that requires an entirely different mindset, right? The mindset is not about how much money do I save. It's not about, are we all on the same Linux kernel version? The goal now is, how do we get something released? And if you start from that goal, then you naturally, I mean, perfectly naturally go right to public cloud.
Right. Yeah, so something else that we were talking about yesterday was the fact that when you get to the point where you have a no-code or low-code or an easy way for business to actually build applications, a question that I've heard is that, should business even have the power to build these applications by themselves?
Yes. unequivocally, yes. Because IT is often the place where innovation goes to die. And the lines of business, right? Marketing, for example, sales, all of those business functions are much closer to the customer than any IT developer sitting somewhere is. They're always closer. And with today's technology, the barrier to entry, it's not like they're writing C++ applications,
right?
And with these low and no-code solutions, we have serverless now, we have these very mature public clouds, we have a lot of good platform as a service offerings out there, and you have vendors like us at Commerce Tools, you have a lot of vendors out there who sell these building blocks for applications as little discrete pieces. And if you have a big library of things you can choose from, either within your enterprise or available on the open market, whether it's through your cloud vendor or through somebody like us who's a little bit more specialized, it becomes really easy then to build something. And again, it's all about iteration. Amazon released 50 million times to production in 2015. And I don't know what the current number is. I'd be very curious to find out what that is. But I'll bet it's a lot higher than 50 million times. And if you ask a traditional retailer how quickly they release something to production, the fastest I'll ever hear is 3 or 4 weeks. Most of the time, it's 6 to 8 weeks to release anything whatsoever to production. And that's just, when you've got Amazon breathing down your neck as a retailer, you just can't afford to do that. That old style does not work anymore.
Right, right. Well, this is a fascinating topic, but since I have you here, I'll ask, you know, I'm going into different conversations as well. So, looking at the Amazon and really the leadership in the commerce, Walmart is really making some very interesting moves. What are your thoughts on how Walmart is, you know, with the new leadership on the e-commerce side is actually making progress?
I should preface this by saying I worked at Walmart for 3.5 years. I was the lead ATG architect when they did their ATG implementations around the world. So I've seen Walmart up close and personal for a long time. I like the message that they're projecting to the market. I think Mark Lurie was a great hire, acqui-hire, if you want to call it that. He's built a great team around him. I like what Jet did. Right? Jet is all microservices-based. They're really the poster child for this new style of development, and I think they really infused a lot of good talent into the organization. The challenge I have is ISD, so this is corporate Walmart in Bentonville, Arkansas. Those people are incredibly unlike the people on either of the coasts, right? So Jet, the whole Jet team is in New Jersey, and Walmart.com historically is in Silicon Valley. And they're just enormous cultural differences. And the pace of change is much, much slower in Bentonville. So even to provision, you know, capacity, provision a server, you know, that was a whole process. And I'm not picking on Walmart, but any large IT organization has those challenges. So the question I have, and I haven't seen it yet, but I think they're making the right direction, is how quickly can Bentonville and that whole ISD team actually move? And that'll be really interesting to see.
Great point. And also, what exactly is the linkage of the e-commerce site to the ISD infrastructure still? And is that changing, like with the cloud?
To some degree. I mean, historically, all of the Walmart applications were hosted out of the two data centers, one just outside of Bentonville, Arkansas, and one just down the road from there. And so they've been doing the physical infrastructure and hosting. But I'm not sure. It's been a few years since I've been there, so I don't know what it is anymore. I think the big test for them would be, if I were to go in as a, you know, developer at Walmart, would they allow me access to a public cloud?
Right.
I think that's the big decider for me is, you know, if the answer to that is an unequivocal yes, you can go play with something, I think Walmart will have made the transition they need to make. But if they say you've got to go ticket ISD, I don't know.
Right. You're basically back in the old cycle. Which
right.
is, yeah. So here's another question is, is Walmart working on their own public cloud offering? And if not, why?
They've built their own PaaS, and they've had a lot of traction with that. But I don't think it's their goal to do their own cloud. I haven't seen it yet, at least. And they haven't been making the hires that would be required to do that.
Right. Would be interesting. I mean, it's not an easy thing to do, so...
I don't know if there's room in the market for that. Honestly, I think they're too late.
Right.
Because right now, you know, it's AWS. It's AWS, it's Google, it's Microsoft that own that space.
Right.
And they've been benefiting from, you know, what Amazon calls a flywheel, right? Where innovation brings customers and revenue that's pumped back into the business. And they're able to hire a lot of these million-plus-dollar-a-year developers. And the amount of work that's gone into creating these platforms at scale is just enormous. I mean, they're getting... All of the major cloud vendors have laid their own cables across the oceans. I mean, it's at that level of capital investment. And I don't know if the Walmarts of the world would have the cash to do that or the desire. I mean, Walmart's a retailer selling, you know, kids' clothing in rural America. And for them to lay a fiber cable across the Atlantic and try to compete with the Googles and Microsofts and Amazons of the world is a pretty big stretch for them.
Right. I mean, I agree. But ultimately, if you don't control that part of the chain for yourself, you're always dependent. And that's a very key part of the business, even more important as, you know, we grow. Like, you know, think about 10 years, 20 years from now, where you only have three cloud vendors. And you're a company like Walmart, the largest by revenue in the world.
Yeah.
That's a pretty limiting thing as far as, like, you know, when I was thinking about it as the CIO or whatever. So that's why I'm asking that question, is that, yes, it's expensive, but how important is control over your own destiny?
I think raw compute power has become a commodity. It's a utility at this point. So if somebody else can provide, as they say, ping, power, and pipe, right? Mm-hmm. Somebody else can do that work, I think you're set. I don't think it's that big of a differentiator to own the hypervisor, the network layer. I think you can go to just about any cloud vendor today and get a bare metal server of some sort. And that's where I've seen Walmart innovate, is at that PaaS layer on up. And if they can deploy their PaaS somewhere and have it work, I think they're probably okay.
Right. So I'm wondering, like, so another question is, like, for retailers, anybody in retail, which cloud should they use? And I know you've personally have been through some decisions on that. And so I don't know this detail, but I'm thinking, which cloud would Walmart be using? Google?
I don't know. I can tell you what we went through at Commerce Tools. So we are 100% cloud-based. So we spend a lot of money with cloud vendors. And when we launched the platform in 2013, we were on Rackspace because that's what was pretty popular back then. So we needed a new vendor. And early last year, we started the selection process. And immediately we ruled out AWS. And it pained me to do it. But we had to do it for two reasons. The first and the most important is our customers, as retailers, many of them retailers, don't want to feed the very thing that is putting them out of business. The other issue is we are all based on Kubernetes, and at the time, AWS did not have a Kubernetes PaaS. So those were two disqualifying criteria for us. Then it came down to Google or Microsoft. I like the more hands-on process at Microsoft. We were able to talk to a lot of product experts and really learn about the offering and get that sales support that we needed, but they weren't pushy about it, which I appreciated. Google basically told us to RTFM, very politely. But if you actually read the manual, Google we found to be probably about the same as Microsoft. It was a touch cheaper. Which was nice, and that does make a difference. They also had a better Kubernetes PaaS. And I know Azure has made pretty substantial investments in Kubernetes. And I think it's probably on par now with what Google offers. But, you know, it was a tough call, but we ultimately went with Google. We are in the process of also supporting Azure as well. I think all three of them are more than good enough for 99% of use cases out there, though. All three of the clouds are just fine these days.
Right.
But if you drop below that tier, that's where things get pretty dicey.
Yeah, so as a retailer, what? And I know a lot of retailers hesitate to go to Amazon, AWS because of what you mentioned. But really, if you are thinking about only the benefits of what the platform is providing to you, and you have the visibility and you have the confidence that your data is secure and safe and it's being treated fairly just like everybody else based on your, you know, subscription plan or, you know, terms of service, wouldn't that be like a short-sighted decision to not use the best service out there, as, you know, as far as like, you know,
but
again,
it's
a question. I don't know the answer, but
once you hit a certain threshold, all three of the cloud vendors are fine. And for us, we needed Kubernetes.
Right.
Full stop. That's what we needed.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, there are small benefits on one side or the other. And we do use AWS for a handful of things. Route 53 for DNS, we use that. We use a lot of Lambda because it is better. But all three of the clouds met our minimum level of needs. And the issue we have is a sales issue. Again,
right.
People really have a gut-level reaction to, in any way, subsidizing. I mean, Amazon took in, what, 59% of all retail spend over the holiday season in the U.S.? I mean, 59%. Nobody wants to subsidize, and I don't know how true this is, but it sounds like AWS has been subsidizing the .com e-commerce business, and nobody wants any part of that. So technically, yes, if developers rule the world, we'd probably be on AWS today. But people who run businesses, unfortunately, do, and they're not open to AWS for that exact reason. There was little that AWS offered uniquely that would substantially improve our business. It's not like
right.
By choosing Google, we're missing out on something big. They have a great stack.
Yeah, they have a great stack. A lot of decisions as far as, you know, what cloud to use also go to what is it that I have in-house right now, what's being built right now. So if you're on the .NET and Microsoft stack, you definitely want to look at Azure first, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a differentiating aspect on the other two? Like if you're on a certain technology, you look at Google first?
I think Kubernetes, of course. I mean, it originated at Google, so
right.
People who are using Kubernetes, which seems to be the world, you probably get a little better experience on Google because it's their native PaaS.
Native, right.
I know some of the second tier vendors offer really good support for lift and shift. So the public clouds today are largely oriented around new app development. So the concept is you're building a new app for cloud. But some of the more legacy vendors out there, so IBM through their SoftLayer acquisition, Oracle, SAP, they all have clouds that really facilitate this. I don't know, think of it as a forklift approach, right? Taking your existing footprint and moving it over. And yes, you've moved it to the cloud technically, but you've not really adopted any of the principles.
Right.
But some of those solutions are good for that use case. And that's where it might make sense to look for a more legacy or a solution by a legacy vendor where their customers are more moving existing apps than creating new apps.
Okay, great. All right, so in closing, what's new with Commerce Tools?
We just last week released a really amazing feature, and this is market leading. We're really excited about it. We allow for Lambda functions, Google Cloud functions, and Azure Cloud functions to be synchronously injected into our platform. So we're an API-based commerce platform, right? Our customers call our APIs. And you've long been able to extend our data model, right? So if you want to add different attributes to products or categories, that's been pretty easy to do. But anything more than that, and you have to build these wrapper applications, right? Where you're wrapping the call and then extending it, basically, mm-hmm. as you do with any commerce platform. The third approach, which a lot of our customers have historically done, is they've subscribed to messages in our system. So we allow the ability to subscribe to things like order placement events. And then you could asynchronously execute a Lambda function to say when an order submitted event is propagated, right? It's dumped on the queue, grab that message off the queue and send the customer an email to say, thank you for placing the order, right? But now what we allow is the ability to, when you're making the call into our API, at different points in the execution path, we'll pass off the request to a Lambda function of your choice. So your extensions now can be implemented directly inside the platform, and then the response goes back. And this allows you to reuse all the existing SDKs that we offer. The entire ecosystem on top of our stack can remain unchanged, but you can implement your custom business logic in serverless functions.
That sounds very interesting.
I'll do a blog post on it soon, but it's really exciting. Cool. And that's the kind of thing that we need as we establish ourselves and continue to establish ourselves as the thought leaders in the market. Those are the types of features we'll be pretty rapidly coming out with. Type of thing that nobody else is doing today. We spent a lot of time on it.
Right.
And there's a lot of business value because now you don't have to manage these little applications anymore. You just have a collection of these little Lambda functions that you can update independently.
Right.
So it's an entirely different model. It's something that we're really proud of doing.
So any retailers that are open and actually looking and testing with these?
Well, we just released it Wednesday. So.
Right, right. But no, from other like retailers that you hear of, I mean, even the concept of using really like going into the microservices.
All the big retailers are doing microservices APIs. I mean, the whole Jet.com acquisition was for that type of talent, right? People mm-hmm. who can build microservices. But even like Nordstrom, for example, Nordstrom has a serverless department, right, where they have people who build serverless apps. But a lot of these guys. I mean, Neiman Marcus has an innovation right. lab, and they allow their developers to go provision capacity and play with all this stuff. So, yeah, it's pretty common out there.
So all the big players are doing it. Where is the, I guess, the slowest sector? Is it like the middle ground?
It's middle-tier retailers.
Right.
Who are not located in tech hubs.
Yeah.
And retailers are conservative by nature, which I understand.
Right.
So that's made them fairly resistant to technology. Many of them have also been captured by the bigger software vendors. So the IBMs and SAPs of the world have captured a lot of them. And they've conditioned them not to look outside for cool new technology. Hiring is a big issue as well. And, getting the right people.
They can't.
A good top-level architect who can do this work. And again, you don't need that many architects, but a good top-level architect wants $500,000 a year. And you go to a retailer where merchandisers are making $30,000 and $40,000 a year, and people who've been with a company for decades are making $60,000 maybe, you know?
Right.
And to say now we're going to spend $500,000 on this kid in a hoodie? You know, like that's a cultural change that many mid-tier retailers are unwilling to make.
But so do you really need at that top level architecture in, you know, in what we're talking about is where you have these services and let's say, you know, like from Commerce Tools or a similar type of company, a company is offering these services. What you need, and in this new world of everything being served on the cloud, you don't have to worry about the infrastructure as much as you did before. You need to know what services you want to use,
right?
And plug them in. And of course, the big part is the CX, the customer experience, and how it's being. So for that, for figuring that out, do you really need that level of an architect?
You need a couple. You need two or three. And I'll give you an example. AWS, how many services does AWS have? 130, probably?
Probably. I don't know for sure.
And it's none of these services are particularly hard to learn. But to build a big enterprise-class app that's deployed across multiple regions, multiple availability zones, that takes some real talent. You know, that's hard to do. And it's more about knowing what pieces are there and how to use them. And then the lower level developers can take those pieces, learn them, and build the apps. But there have to be a couple people who really understand this intuitively and can declare edicts, right? So for example, the 12-factor app that Pivotal came out with, or sorry, it was Heroku, and then I think it was adopted by Pivotal. You know, that's an edict saying, you know, these are the 12 factors of a cloud-native app. And you need a thought leader like that within an enterprise to say, these are a handful of basic standards, right? These are the five programming languages you can choose from.
When we talk about no code, going back to where we started, low code or no code, to be able to look at the technology as a service and pick and choose these services and plug them in without any technical work.
Right. And low and no code is the logical end state of that.
Right.
Because it allows citizen developers and less technical business users to go build these apps from this big library of a couple hundred different APIs that are exposed to the enterprise. So it's an entirely different way of working, but it makes sense. It makes a lot of sense. And the big players out there are already seeing results from that. You know, look at Walmart. They've been doing really well. Amazon, of course. You know, all the big tech players have done this, and that's their competitive differentiation.
Awesome. And on that note, thank you so much. I know you have to go catch your flight. So it was great talking to you again.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.